to start with a disclaimer. I don't do sermons. I'm not a preacher. This is my story. And I want you to forgive me for what I'm about to do to you. This is my story. This is my song. Praising my Savior all the day long. This is my story. This is my song. Praising my Savior all the day long. You can hear the... That's what this is about. I'm going to try and keep it, because right now, how many of you know what a dirt devil is? That's what's going on right now in my head. All the things that I wanted to talk about today are swirling around, and I'm going to try and pull them back down and make sense out of it. I was not raised in the church. I didn't become a Christian or give my life to Jesus until I was 40. I went through quite a few things in my childhood. My father was an alcoholic. He died at the ripe old age of 35 when I was 14 of cirrhosis of the liver, bringing on a coronary. My mother had 7 children by her first husband. He left her with the babysitter to get away from the FBI because he was running away from the draft. And she suffered a fire in her house, lost 3 children in the fire, and 1 of pneumonia shortly after. That created some psychological problems from her. 2 of my older brothers, my little sister and I, when she married my father, and I wasn't exactly the obedient child. Those of you that have known me for a long time know that I have a mind of my own, and I've always felt free to speak it, but not necessarily in what you would consider a Christian manner, as I try to do now. And when I offend someone, I try to apologize now. That's part of becoming a Christian. And I've tried to do that here, and I think there's some people that could attest that I have done so. In high school, I drank a lot. The drinking age back in New York was 18. And at 16, I started drinking because my mother used to say, if I thought you're going to be just like your father, I'd kill you right now. Can you imagine how that affects you? It just made me think that, you know, I was going to die by the time I was 35, too. And it almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy with car accidents. I was in 5 totals in 2 years. One of them, I left the road doing better than 140 miles an hour in a 55 Chevy Nomad. I was racing against my friend, and I had my car, but his car was at his house. We were sitting at the town tavern in Victor, New York, and we had a few too many drinks, and he called my car a sled, and being the macho man that I was, I said, let's race. So I took him to his house, and his mother knew us. You know, I mean, we all used to hang out there, and she was a strong Christian, and when she heard the cars rumbling out in the driveway, she got out of bed and prayed. Thank God that she prayed. Because within 5 minutes, I had left the road at the speed that I told you earlier. 187 feet, hit the stone wall. The reason the stone wall was there is to keep me from going into the ravine. There's a creek running through the bottom of the ravine. I landed 33 feet the other side of it. When I left the road, I was pointed away. And when I landed, I was on all 4 pointing back towards the road. One leg was up on the front seat, one leg was pinned to the ground by the door, and my 2 hands were holding onto the steering wheel because didn't have seat belts in a 55. But my buddy made up a little song. This is it. He flew through the air with the greatest of ease. A 55 Chevy went right through the trees. He landed on 4, but oh, what a mess. And when he got up, he said he was blessed. Now, whether I said that or not, I don't know, but he did. And that's when I found out, you know, that his mother had been praying. I got married too young for the wrong reason and got divorced again. I went into the Air Force in 1973. That kind of straightened me out a bit. It made me grow up. to a degree. Didn't stop my drinking. Celebrated quite heavily. My son was born on my birthday, 1973. And on Thanksgiving Day, she left me, filed for divorce. And I was all by myself on the base. I was a weapons instructor, had access to the Army 24/7 without escort. And so I found myself with a bottle of Jack Daniels sitting in the sand on the range with a loaded 38. And fortunately, one of the guys that I worked with suspected that I was having issues and went looking for me, and he drove around the base and he saw my car out there at the range. And he came out and he walked in and very kindly took the 38 from me and unloaded it, and then came back out and kicked my butt and asked me if I knew how selfish I was, that I would do that to friends, family. Think about your son. Do you want him to look at you the way you looked at your father? You know, he made a point. But my experience with faith to that point even was negative. I worked on a dairy farm for 3 years. I put myself in a foster home when I was 12 because of my father. I graduated from his hand to a belt to a 2x4 shaped in the form of a paddle. And when that happened, that's when I went to the welfare and asked them to put me in a home. So they put me on a dairy farm. Changed my life to a degree. Everything seems to be in a degree. Now, what I look back on these things is that at times in my life when I was the most desperate, and that God put people in my life. People came along that pulled me out of whatever hole I was in. The gentleman that came out to the range was a devout Baptist. You know, I mean, the people on the dairy farm that I worked on were devout Catholics. And I went with them to church every Sunday. It was mandatory. And so I sat through all the masses and that and learned the songs. And the second year I was on that farm, they had a little girl. And they took the girl in to have it christened. And they had it christened. And of course, you know, you're expected to make a donation to the church. And so I was there, and about a week and a half later, they got a letter from the church. And the two of them were sitting on the couch crying, bawling their eyes out, because they were sent a letter from the church saying, you could have donated more. That ended my going to church on Sundays with them. And you go, you know, if you want to be treated like that. I was disgusted with man, let alone the church. Please forgive me. When I got off of there, I had failed seventh grade because I didn't attend very much. And that was the first year. The second year after I'd been on the dairy farm, I was an honor graduate. I was on the honor roll. It changed me to that degree. I wanted to succeed. I wanted to be different. And that year, my father died. So when my father died, my mother moved to a new town. And I was pretty established. I had actually gone to that school for a whole 3 years in my life. And if you knew my life, you'd know how miraculous that was for me to be in one spot for 3 years. Because, you know, I mean, we had six different places to live by the time I was five. And never knew. I never had the same bed, never had the same couch. You know, so, I mean, you don't get attached to material things. You don't know when it's going to be gone. And people came and went through your life, you know. Uncles, aunts, uncles died, ones that, you know, you really cared about. And you look at them in the casket, and what does that mean? Because I really hadn't had any training or that to deal with that kind of stuff. It's just something you buried in here. I got kicked out of school 6 months before graduation because I was such a hood. Now, this followed me from the eighth grade, when we moved to that school in the new city when my father died. Totally different environment. It was in a suburb of a big city, and I was considered trailer trash because we lived in a mobile home. I was a singer. I loved singing. I sang in choir in the old schools. I sang in choir, joined choir in this new school. But I was skinny, and I used to like to dress up. I even wore bow ties. A pink and black one I had. And what I found out is in this area, that wasn't acceptable because I was now a queer, a faggot, and someone not to be. Now, one of the things I didn't tell you is that in the old school, I lived in a Polish neighborhood going to a school on the Italian side of town. The Polish people did not let their kids play with us because we weren't Catholic. The Italians didn't let their kids play with us because we weren't Italian. And the Italian boys would be waiting for you at school, you know, just off the school grounds, waiting for you to come so they could get your lunch money. So I learned to fight. You know, you could take my lunch money, you know, and tear up my books, but it wasn't going to be free. There'd be a price to pay. And so coming from that background and going to this new school and kids treating me the way they were, I had a younger sister that was a year and a half younger than me. She died 2 weeks before I went in the Air Force. An overdose. But this kid named Danny Cole, he was the biggest hood that ever walked the face of the earth in that time in my life. And he used to pick on my sister. And one day I met him at the top of the stairs, and he had just pushed my sister's books down the stairs. He followed the books. And I followed him all the way down the stairs. And every time he got up, I pushed him down the next flight. When we got down to the bottom, I stuffed them in a locker and locked it. That established my reputation for the rest of my school years. I was a hood. I was a gangster, a punk. So what I had to do, first of all, I quit choir because I had to change my image. Second of all, I started walking around with combat boots, you know, engineer boots, okay, with buckles on them. A white t-shirt with a pack of Marlboros folded up in the sleeve. I wasn't bothered anymore with the queer or faggot stuff because of what I had done. It didn't change me. I was still the same person. But I knew what I had to do to keep from being constantly harassed. I quit school when I was 16. I was going to go in the Marine Corps with my best buddy who thought he was Audie Murphy's reincarnation. And it didn't work out that way because his mother signed and mine wouldn't. So he left. I went to work at a thoroughbred racetrack. I loved horses. I loved animals. I had a special way with animals. And I was working as a groom, pony boy, and hot walker at a thoroughbred racetrack. The things that I saw there drove me back to school. The people driving up in black limousines and getting out and walking up, putting their hand inside the stall, getting out, and the horse dying on the track later that day. Other things that I won't even go into here because this is church. But that drove me back to school. So my mother went before the school board because the principal wouldn't let me back in. His name was Carl A. Palumbo. And he wasn't going to let me back in no way, no how, because he's the one that threw me out of school to begin with, or later, sorry. I'm trying to bring these points down out of that. Anyway, they made me agree to a whole lot of rules that other kids didn't have to let me back in. First of all, I had to take a summer school and take two courses. Now, given what you know about me already, what I've told you, they made me take physical science and typing. I had to take both of those and pass them both to be able to get back into school to even restart. So I took them, and I surprised them. I passed them both with flying colors. I was the fastest hunting pecker you ever saw. You know, there was none of this. There was, but I managed to pass the test. So I'm back in school, and I found out that I had issues. I didn't know what they were at the time, but I had colitis, and I couldn't control my bowel. It's followed me all my life, and I left home when I was 16 after getting back into school. My stepfather tried to kill me, literally. He sat on my chest on the floor in the kitchen and was choking me out. If it wasn't for my mother having been right there, she picked a pan off the stove because my head was right by the oven of the stove. And I looked up, you know, my eyes are starting to flutter, and I looked up and I saw that pan come down across the top of his head. And he didn't blink the first time she hit him. The second time, he made a few expletives and rolled off of me, and I was out the front door and never lived at home again. But those are the kinds of things, you know, that, I mean, you ask yourself why. Fortunately, I had neighbors again that cared about me. Neighbors that had nothing to me other than the fact that they were a neighbor. And they knew what kind of life I was living in the home. They taught me how to water ski, took me out boating, let me drive the boat, got my boat driving license. You know, I mean, those are the kinds of people that I found myself helping me when, you know, they came out of nowhere. They put me in a boys' detention home to protect me from my father, stepfather. Guess what I had to do every day? Fight. Because they wanted my cigarettes. And so by the time I went before the judge, my reputation superseded me. And I walked in. Now, my mother said when the police took me away that she was going to be packing, and we'd have, by the time I got out, we'd have a new place to live. So, mind you, I'm doing this. I'm going through this stuff at the boys' detention home. And it's time, my time to go to court. So the sheriff comes and gets me, takes me to court. When I walk in the room, the judge is sitting there, and guess who's sitting there side by side holding hands? My mother and my stepfather who tried to kill me. And he proceeded to tell me how I, Nolan, was responsible for everything. You know, I was the reason my mother and stepfather didn't get along. It was my fault. I was a hood. I was, you know, trouble. And that if I made one problem for my parents, he'd have me back in that home until I was 18. Do you understand me? Yes, sir. And I went home, very quietly sat in the back of the car, walked in the house, got a couple of grocery bags, packed my stuff, and left. That was the last time I lived at home. But in the meantime, I'm still going to school. Now, the people that I moved in with were Chuck Boysey, the man that thought he was Audie Murphy incarnate. His family took me in. And she's the one that discovered that I had a real bad bowel problem. And so they took me to the hospital. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. Now, given the rules that I was given me to get back into school, I had actually decided that I wanted to graduate. In fact, I thought I was going to be a draftsman. That's what I wanted to do. So when they let me back in school, the first thing I get called down to Carl A. Palumbo's office, and he tells me that I'm going to stay every night after school, no sports, no nothing, until all of my classwork was made up. Now, mind you, the 2 weeks that I was in the hospital, my mother went to the school to try and get my homework. so that I could do it while I was in the hospital. And they said, no, he can do it when he gets back. So that's what I did. But I had two English teachers in my senior year, and 11th and 12th grade English. And the first class of the day was my 12th grade English. So I asked her, I said, you know, this is what I've been told I have to do. She said, well, you'll stay after for me then. Okay, you know. And then later in the afternoon, I had my 11th grade English teacher and told her. And she said, oh, you'll stay for me tonight. And I said, no, ma'am, I can't. I'm staying for Mrs. So-and-so. No, you're staying for me. I'm a student, you know. I don't have authority. You know, you'll have to take it up with Mr. Palumbo. Next thing I know, I'm down there in the office, and he tells me I'm the one that's supposed to work it out. So he and I didn't get along. And at the end of 6 months before graduation, I was expelled permanently because I cut art class and went to mechanical drawing class, and I broke the rule. That was the opportunity they were looking for. And not only did they expel me from Victor Central, but from Canandaigua, Geneva, they blackballed me so that I couldn't get back into school so that I could graduate. I was not a flunky student. I was an A student, but that's the rules. You break them, you're gone. So I got my GED in 1970. I was working as a carpenter, building houses on an assembly line. I was the assistant foreman. I never got the foreman's job because I wasn't old enough. They told me that people wouldn't work for me because I was too young at 21. And the funny part about it was is that I had 18 people working for me every day because the foreman was always over having coffee. So when it came time to what each person was going to be assigned that day, it was me. And they hired 5 people off the street for me to train to be my boss, but would never give me the position because I was too young. Well, after being laid off 3 years in a row, you know, and that was every November in New York, you only work 8 months out of the year if you're working in the building trades. You know, either snow or rain because of the mud. So I decided to get my ability to go to college by going in the military. So I enlisted in the Air Force, and I spent 4 years in the Air Force on active duty, got married again. That's how I ended up in Oregon, because while I was there, I married an Oregon girl. And when I got out and moved to Oregon, I started going to college to be a police officer. I got my degree. I went on 32 ride-alongs with the city of Portland and found out that that was not for me, as much as I wanted to be, because there were several police officers in my life that had made a difference, and I wanted to repay that debt. That's the way I looked at it. It was a debt that I owed. And one of them was when I was 7 years old, and my mother was threatening to give me to the state because of shoplifting, stealing baby coach wheels, and go-karts out of things like that. And after a beating from my father, I went down to the local police station in Newlyn, New York, and turned myself criminal that I am. I walked in, and it's the typical thing that you see, you know, with the desk up high and the two lights and an officer sitting there. And I walk in, and he says, what can I do for you, sonny? I said, I want to turn myself in. He chuckled. He said, really? I said, yeah. He says, well, what all have you done? And I told him. And he said, well, what brings you here today? Why did you come in here today? And I told him my mom was going to give me away to this day. And he says, well, if I write a letter, I center of town. And I'm driving through, and lights come on, and I pull over. And the officer walks up to the car. It was a state patrolman. And he says, have you been drinking? Yes, sir. He says, how much? And I said, too much. And he said, well, you know, let's take a drive. So I thought I was on my way to the police station. And as it turns out, about 3 miles down the road was a Shell station that had a diner that was open 24 hours. And he pulls in front of that, and he says, come on, let's go inside. And he went inside. He talked to me for about 45 minutes about what I was doing, the danger. And I kind of expressed to him, you know, that I was living out my father's life. And he said, well, that's your choice, if that's what you choose to do, but you do have a choice in life. Anyway, after 45 minutes, he took me home instead of to the police station where I probably should have been. I wish I could say that I was smart enough after that to not drink anymore and drive, but I wasn't. The night that I wrecked that 55 Chevy Nomad, I had an open beer between my legs and an unopened one on the seat. The state police cited me for driving too fast for weather conditions because it was snowing. Yeah, we're racing in the snow. Anyway, by the time I graduated, I was divorced again because what I found out was that I knew that my wife had dated police officers when I met her, my second wife. And I thought she loved me, but what she loved was the idea of being married to a police officer. So after the ride-along that I went on where the police officer rescued me from myself, and by that I mean because I had child abuse in my life, I found we were in a situation, we responded to a domestic call. And when we got there, I was always allowed to stay behind the police officer. And I walked in and I saw that little bloody kid. And I went by the police officer. And he grabbed me by the collar because he suspected that I was on my way to do something stupid. And I was, because I saw that kid, and that's all I wanted to do was give him, you know, that father, something to think about. And you can see that it's still. But I thought about it and realized that by the time I got my degree, it was not for me because I would end up in prison myself. Wouldn't be good for society, wouldn't be good for me. So I was working for Sears in security work, arresting shoplifters and employee thieves. But I didn't have to worry about domestic stuff. So I excelled at that. I mean, I was a shoplifter when I was 7. I knew what to look for. And that's not bragging again either. That's just the way it is. I excelled at it, and so they promoted me up here to Pasco. And in my arrogance, I got married again to a drug addict. And it took me 6 months to figure out what was happening. She had 2 little kids, and they started calling me daddy. And the fact that my first wife took my son from me, I was all set to be a daddy. That's all I ever wanted to be. And so that kind of made me hang in there longer than I would have. But I finally left, and I found out that I was $15,000 in debt in furniture that I didn't know about because that's how she paid her drug dealer. She would take them into stores. I don't know if you remember a woman named Pina Adams that used to advertise, you know, for furniture sales and stuff. But she would go in there with her drug supplier and have them pick out what furniture they wanted and then pay for it in my name. I didn't know that in the state of Washington, you can do that. Community property. And so my name was her property. She never did change it, you know. But after paying off the $15,000 in debt, I really thought about my place in life and what was driving me to make these stupid choices. Lust. Pure and simple. But I needed a change. And so along comes my wife, my fourth wife. But we dated for 2 years before we got married. The others, the longest one was 6 months. And she says today, she's not my fourth wife. She's my last wife. And she means it. We've been married going on 36 years. Somehow or other, the Lord brought me to the right place, 3,300 miles from New York, out here to find the person that was my soulmate. And fortunately, I was smart enough to see it. We were married in the First Congregational Church of Pasco by Pastor Dan. And he played one heck of a difference in my life. His way of bringing you to the Lord. He knew me. He knew how to get to me. Because I was a devil's advocate. Somebody come talk to me about faith, I told them all about the way I felt about faith. And you know, the ironic part about it is when I listen to people today talk about anti-faith, they're using the same arguments I used. God, somebody ought to be real. Needs to come up with something new. But nobody told me the truth. It wasn't until I started coming to church, you know, that I actually found out the truth about grace. For me, and through what little training I had, everything had to do with the Ten Commandments. I already knew. I broke several of those. So I wasn't going to be saved. I was going to be one of those that went to the eternal fire. Nobody ever said a word about grace. Nobody ever told me about David, a man after God's own heart. Those are things I didn't learn until I started going to church, and I'm going, wow, maybe there is hope for me. You see this coat? This made one of the biggest differences in my life that I could ever tell you about. When I got back from that 1993 Promise Keepers, I spent 6 hours about what I had learned. It changed me drastically. The idea of becoming a member of the church, the idea of serving your pastor, not just going back, because at that time they told us, most of the churches are run by the women. They're the ones that carry it. They're the ones that raise money, you know. Now, what they told us about men was that they didn't really want to get involved, but they'd write a check. What they needed was men to go back and get involved in their church. My best friend Randy, you know, he and I went to that 1993 Promise Keepers together, and we both came away different. What we experienced, we were in Watson Stadium in Eugene, Oregon, and there was dark clouds everywhere you could look outside that stadium, rain. And inside that stadium, there was sunshine and a little mist, not your typical Oregon rain, but a real light mist, but sunshine coming right down through. And the Lord took all that baggage that I was carrying for all those years from me. And Randy can vouch, you know, that I stood there and it felt, came back and got involved in the church. I served on the board many, many times for many, many years. I have a strong opinion about our Lord. I picked the songs that we sang today. I picked the verses because they mean something so dear to me. I'm changed. If you actually knew the person that I was back before I was 40, you wouldn't like me. And the people back then don't believe what's happened to me since. So I know there's been a change. I'm going to take a look here, see if I've... A couple of times I went to Pastor Dan. After I was baptized, he baptized me in the Columbia River because some people wanted to baptize me in a hot tub, you know, come on. So he agreed to baptize me. We went out into the Columbia River in September. It was fun. But shortly after that, I experienced, you know, this voice in my head. Almost constant talking in my ear. And I went to Dan and I said, what is going on? You know, ever since I gave my life to Christ, you know, there's more stuff going on. And he says, yeah. Because back then he wasn't worried about you. He had you. He said, now he doesn't. And so he's working on you overtime. And he said, it happens to a lot of Christians. He said, just ignore it because he's a liar. Then another time, I worked for 20 years in the x-ray service field, servicing x-ray processing equipment, driving all over Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. I loved the people that I worked with out of the accounts. I hated the two people I worked for. That's not a good combo. And I really believe in this, men of integrity. I was told one time when I was in the Air Force, because that's what I tried to do, even though I wasn't a Christian wholeheartedly at the time. Anyway, Dan talked to me about them. I said, you know, I'm having a hard time because I've had thoughts about actually trying to find a way to have those people rubbed out. That's not a very Christian thought. And he said, you know, he said, maybe you need to quit working for them. Well, you know, I need a job. And he said, no, he said, go to work for the Lord. I'm, okay, explain that to me. Don't quit my job, but go to work for the Lord. He says, when you go to work in the morning, he said, go to work for the Lord. Do the Lord's work. And act like you're working for the Lord. 2 weeks later, my bosses called me in the office. They said, you don't seem as antagonistic as you were. What's going on? I don't know what you're talking about. You're just not as angry, you know? You're more polite when you walk through. Okay, thank you, Lord. After 20 years, I was medically retired. I've had a few medical issues in my life. I won't go into all those. But there's been a couple times when they told my wife to get my family together. One of those was the second carotid surgery. One of those was the open heart surgery. But I believe, you know, again, if I brag about Pastor Dan, when they shipped me to Sacred Heart to have open heart surgery, I'm laying in the bed, and I've got a bed that looks right down the hallway. And I'd been there for about an hour, and I looked up, and who's walking down the aisle towards my room is Pastor Dan. And I can tell you right now, fear disappeared. I don't know why. You know, he isn't God, but he is a mentor to me that I trust that he's there to represent the Lord. And my fear about having my chest cut open, gone. Because I believe more today than I did yesterday. And I hope you'll forgive me for any mistakes that I may have made. And I'm going to do this to you again. Perfect submission. All is at rest. I can't read my own writing. I and my Savior am happy and blessed, watching and wanting, looking above, filled with his goodness, lost in his love. That's the way I feel, folks. I hope this meant something. Thank you.